It's a bit silly to start our show with the Largo from Vivaldi's Winter when it's now midsummer. But let's stick to our theme tune, come winter, spring, summer, or fall. All we have to do is call, as you remember. And it's me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, calling you to attend to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge. It's good to know that we are now able to stream the show. So if you cannot listen on FM radio, you can hear us online at cambridge105.fm, where you can find a button labeled Listen Now. Click that and you can, well, listen now. Maybe that's what you're doing right now. And you can listen again when the show is posted on our own website, momentsunderlamplight.com. You can find archives of the shows from the whole past year. Yes, the whole past year. Cambridge 105 is celebrating its first anniversary this month. You might want to look out for some special events. Oh, and I don't want to forget to remind you that you can always reach me here at my special Cambridge 105 email address, lamplight@cambridge105.fm. There's a simple address for you. Drop me a line just to show me that you have taken in this address. Now here's an announcement of what's coming up later this summer. Of course, I'm referring to the annual Cambridge Summer Music Festival, 3.5 weeks of a wide variety of music in the most beautiful settings in Cambridge, from the 15th of July to the 6th of August. You can find out all the details from the website cambridgesummermusic.com. Where you can see who is performing, you can order a brochure, you can purchase tickets. You might want to consider the weekend of jazz at Childerly Hall, a beautiful site just outside Cambridge, where you can picnic in the astoundingly beautiful gardens. And the music will be held in the ancient medieval barn, one of the largest in Europe. You can't miss that. You must go see it. That's the weekend of the 16th and 17th of July with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, including a workshop for children and swing dance with the 78 RPM Jazz Band. Speaking of children, there are several other events for children, including a one-day musical workshop on the 23rd of July at Parkside Community College with the Youth Music Theatre working up a production of Bugsy Malone. Another event you will want to consider is the performance by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collon, in King's College Chapel on the 23rd of July. The Aurora Orchestra, perhaps the most highly acclaimed new chamber orchestra in the country, began in Cambridge, so it's always a pleasure to welcome them back here. And there's one more important event that I cannot forget, and I don't want you to forget either. On Sunday, the 24th of July, please come join the crowds flocking to see Neil Henry in his one-man show, The Music of Magic. Neil, whom I've known personally all his life, is a very talented actor, musician, and magician. Three kinds of performance styles we don't often see coming together in one person. We get Neil's charming stage presence following a musical theme with one magic trick after another woven in. I know, I've seen the script and a run-through, and so I can praise this performance in anticipation. And what's more, Neil is backed by the equally talented Felix Hogan, playing a variety of instruments. Too many for me to have kept track of. As Stephen Fry said a few years ago after watching one of Neil's stage performances, he's like a blend of Rowan Atkinson and my Ironmonger. Yes, he really did say that. So let me repeat. Neil Henry, The Music of Magic, Sunday, 24th of July, at the ADC Theatre, Park Street, Cambridge, 8 o'clock p.m. Now, we've been chatting here before we begin the show, but our theme is waiting for us. We're speaking this evening, under lamplight, about summer heat. There's no way we can predict whether it will be summer heat when you are listening to the show, since there are so many different times and places you might be listening. But whether it's really hot or not, this is the time of year when we at least celebrate summer heat and all its symbolic significance. Before we get into significance, though, let's have a simple little song celebrating the summer heat in the city. Yes, that summer anthem by the Loving Spoonful, Summer in the City. The words are not very complicated, but its concrete details can bring the whole feel of summer in the city back to us. Back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. It's been a long time since I've spent much time in a city in the summer heat, but this detail takes me right back to steamy Philadelphia in the days when I used to work at the Library Company of Philadelphia and ride home in the hot summer late afternoons on the train with my father. No air conditioning, but open windows, blowing hot air and grit on all the tired men in suits reading their evening bulletin. May it rest in peace. But at night it's a different world, the song says. And yes, I remember that too. There was one summer when, after a hard day sitting in the sun, reading from 9 o'clock until 5 o'clock, Dickens, Dante, medieval history, theology, and finally by 4 o'clock, my mind fried, a dose of Ian Fleming. After this rich day of reading, I would join up with Jay, who lived next door, and would let him take me downtown to a bar. I don't remember where the bar was, or even its name, which is unusual for me. That noisy bar was the place I perfected my pinball playing. The deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure played a mean pinball. I think he still does. But I can't find any pinball machines to play on. Well, I never hung out on the rooftops like they do in the song, but I have the feel of it, and perhaps you do too, from West Side Story. My associations with summer night heat lie elsewhere. When we get these soft, balmy nights in England, I am drawn back to Philadelphia's sultriness. Amherst could get pretty oppressive too in that valley, oh, happy valley. And sometimes, to relieve those muggy nights, I take the sleeping bag out into the garden and sleep there, just to breathe the lovely air. The last time I did this, I was woken at 4 o'clock by a few heavy drops falling on me, and before I could dash into the house, I was in the midst of a heavy summer heat thunderstorm. At this distance, it's hard for me to know whether the song itself carries the feel of summer with it, or whether I've just associated it with the summer for so long that the feelings of summertime are forever connected to that driving energy and that odd instrumental in the middle with the Volkswagen Beetle car horn and the jackhammers. Oh, and some vinyl scratching too, I'm afraid. But let's attend to it and let it sweep over us.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
Summer in the city, summer in the city.
Okay, that was The Loving Spoonful with Summer in the City. I don't know if anyone else on Cambridge 105 has played that song recently, but I think there's some kind of law that says it must be played at least once a week throughout the summer. Here's another song about summer heat. You could guess this from the title, which is Too Hot. It's a Kinks song from the 1984 album Word of Mouth, a raucous disco companion piece to Summer in the City. The city is full of activity, people overtaxing themselves, especially in the gym. Remember, this is Thatcher's Britain. We see here the summer heat growing too hot, an image of all the mid-80s self-promoting activity that actually got nowhere, except hotter and hotter, and needed to be cooled off and set in more productive directions. Let's have the words first to help us get settled into the song. Everybody's working out at the gymnasium, pumping iron, getting fit, ready to compete. Everybody working on their own body heat. Everybody hustling out on the street. Julian is out there looking at locations. Arthur's on the picket line, winding up the nation. Sarah Jane's working on her way to a degree, but back in the gymnasium, they're working out and body popping. It's got to stop because it's getting too hot. Cool it down because it's getting too hot. It's getting crazy, going over the top. It's too hot, it's too hot, it's too hot, it's too hot. All the kids are working out, they're on their way to fame. Arthur's on the war path, here he comes again. The city's like a sauna bath, stinks like a drain. They're pumping up the nation, but it's gonna bust a vein. Tourists everywhere blocking up the streets. My ice cream cone just melted in the heat. And while I do my best to stop my raspberry from slopping, back in the gymnasium, they're working out and body popping. It's got to stop because it's getting too hot. The city lights start shining at the end of the day, taking the place of the big red sun as it slowly sets. Meanwhile, back in commuter city, another kid's packing her bags and running away. To a city that is really too hot. It's Piccadilly and it's really too hot. Too hot, too hot, too hot. Arthur's working out, now he's really got the muscle. Julian's over budget, now he's really got to hustle. And Sarah Jane's living on bag takeaways and working as a stripper on the school holidays. Sleazy town gets me down, wants some peace and quiet. The police are everywhere like there's gonna be a riot. But back in the gymnasium, they're training for a war. Think of all the fun we had in 1984. It's got to stop because it's getting too hot. Cool it down because it's getting too hot. It's getting crazy, going over the top. It's too hot, it's too hot, it's too hot, it's too hot.
Everybody's working outside the gymnasium. But back in the gymnasium, they're working out and body popping. It's gotta stop because it's getting too hot. Cool it down because it's getting too hot. It's getting crazy going over the top. Too hot, too hot, too hot, too hot. All the kids are working out, they're on the way to fame. Nation, but it's gonna bust a vein. Tourists
city lights start shining at the end of the day, taking the place of the big red sun as it slowly sets. Meanwhile, back in Community City, another kid's packing her bags and running away. Got the muscle. Julian's over budget, now he's really got to hustle. And Sarah Jane's living on bad takeaways and working as a stripper on the school holidays. Sleazy town gets me down, wants some peace and quiet. The police are everywhere like there's gonna be a riot. But back in the gymnasium, they're training for a war. Think of all the fun we had in 1984. It's gotta stop because it's getting too hot.
That should work us up into a sweat. Think of all the fun we had in 1984. Can you think of any fun you had in 1984? But let's move a little deeper into this summer intensity. As we usually do on these seasonal shows, let's have a listen to a meditation from my CD, Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. A CD that I produced several years ago to try to link together the two worlds of poetry and holistic healing, including ancient Taoist concepts of healing energies, incorporating the five seasons of the year, yes, five, autumn, winter, spring, summer, and harvest, the five elements, metal, water, wood, fire, and earth, the five organs, lungs, kidneys, liver, heart, and spleen, five colors, white, deep blue or black, green, red, golden, brown, and five different pairs of emotional states. For summer, the element is fire, the organ is the heart, the color is red. You can see how all these go together. And the positive emotion is love or compassion. The negative emotion, that abuse of love, we might call aggression, pushing ourselves too hard onto others. Here's the meditation containing poetry from Psalm 19 and poetry from Blake, Dante, St. John of the Cross, T.S. Eliot, and Rumi. The music is composed and performed by none other than Neil Henry.
Summer. Now comes summer, the yang season of male energy, hot, piercing, active. We are in the intensity of the element of fire. The color red, the heart. This energy extends to all things, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. The danger here, the negative emotion, comes from the misuse of the male energy in violence, arrogance, hastiness, cruelty. We can counter this with the positive emotions of delight, joy, love, creativity. In spring, we discovered our new identity. In summer, we delight in manifesting and exercising this new identity, now mature and radiating out from ourselves and making itself known through desire. What is it men in women do require? The lineaments of gratified desire. What is it women do in men require? the lineaments of gratified desire. Summer fire burns us to cleanse us, a terrifying but essential experience. There may be pain here, but no death. When we remember this, we see that the flame is, in fact, a tender flame. O living flame of love that tenderly wounds my soul in its deepest center. This fire of love rescues us from that other fire, the hellish fire of a life cut off from the sacred. Both can burn us, but one destroys while the other heals. The only hope, or else despair, lies in the choice of pyre or pyre, to be redeemed from fire by fire. This summer energy can overwhelm us. This is not the watery drowning of the winter when we cannot grasp what is going on. The fire shows us all too clearly what is going on. We see good and bad at once, and we know both belong to love. Here is my dilemma. Please help me understand. Your love is a healer. Your love is a wise master. Your love is radiant. Your love is delicate and is soft in its essence. I would gladly endure all this fire, all this yearning, all this burning for your love. But if your love is so pleasant, why does it hurt so much? Love hurts because we are vulnerable. The fire offers light and heat to others. So does love, even to the emptying of itself. Love came and became like blood in my body. It rushed through my veins and encircled my heart. Everywhere I looked, I saw one thing: the beloved's name written on my limbs, on my left palm, on my forehead, on the back of my neck, on my right big toe. Oh, my friend, all that you see of me is just a shell, and the rest belongs to the beloved. Here is the generous, joyous energy of summer.
That was the summer meditation from my CD, Journey Through the Seasons. You can find out more about the CD and the 26-page booklet that comes with it by going to www.journeythroughtheseasons.com or clicking on the link at the top of the momentsunderlamplight.com website. Or let me know of your interest and I'll tell you more. Remember me? At lamplight at cambridge105.fm. And remember us? Yes, you're listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge, and we're here with Evening Under Lamplight on the theme of summer heat with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Now, next, I want to read you part of a story. You know, so often I choose passages from Stevenson's essays to read on our Stevenson spot on the show, rather than passages from his fiction, which is what he's most famous for. Well, partly it's because I'm working with Richard, Leslie, and Alex on this new edition of Robert Louis Stevenson's essays in 5 volumes, can you imagine? And so the essays come readily to my mind. And besides, I happen to think they're worth sharing, and you're worth sharing them with. Well, the other problem about not doing fiction is that if we attend to one of the fictional works, I have to abridge it or read just a tiny selection from a larger work. And this evening I am going to read to you an entire chapter from Kidnapped. I don't know how long it's been since you read this novel, but it's a very good book on many levels, and also a surprisingly quick read. Stevenson himself loved to read novels that moved fast. When he was ill in bed, which was several months each year, it seemed, he looked to exciting novels to take him away from the sickbed and the gloomy thoughts and to bring him to a more heroic, colourful world of romance. and when he wrote his own novels, he felt a strong obligation to produce the kind of work that would help others in this way. And many of his novels can be read like that. It's what's called a gripping story, or yarn, as Stevenson might have said. But what raises Stevenson's novels is that they do so much else as well. Kidnapped is a wonderful adventure story involving a spooky, gothic, ruined house and a cruel, miserly uncle, a kidnapping aboard ship, and storms and battles on the ship with pistols and swords, a shipwreck, a murder in the highlands, and then a flight across dangerous, enemy-controlled hills. The action doesn't stop. But at the same time, this is a story about a priggish young lowlander, David Balfour, teaming up with a cocky, charming, annoying Highlander, Alan Breck Stewart. We get not only the clash of temperaments, but also the clash of cultures, Highland and Lowland, Jacobite and Hanoverian. Stevenson carried out extensive research into the customs of the times, not to mention the historical details of the murder and the legal implications. And there's more. Look what happens when I get started on this sort of thing. The book presents a vivid tour of Scottish landscape, capturing the feel of the country in the mid-18th century, and the language, too, with its varieties of dialects. And what always impresses me, it gives us a living sense of David Balfour's first-hand experience in these strange circumstances. Elated one minute, baffled another, outraged or sulky, and also just the physical feeling of cold, hunger, fever, fatigue. In the passage I'll read in a minute, we share clearly what it feels like to sit roasting in a sun trap on a hot day with no water or food or shelter. So now let's have some background. The story takes place in 1751, just after the failed Jacobite rebellion. David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart have witnessed the shooting of a government agent and now are fleeing from the scene, knowing that they will be arrested if discovered. Alan Breck is experienced in hiding from the redcoats, but as the chapter begins, he has lost some of his confidence and is at his last resort as they look for a place to hide in the open land of Glencoe. The Scottish words here will not be too burdensome for you, I'm sure, but here are three words that it would help to know in advance. A lynn, L-Y-N-N, as used here, is a deep and narrow gorge with a river running at the bottom. A burn, B-U-R-N, is a stream, and to bursel means to scorch or broil or toast. It's usually used of food, but here in the summer heat it is used for our heroes exposed to the July sun. We'll start with a bit of music and then move into the chapter. We'll hear Aberlady Lynx, a tune composed by Stevenson, and here arranged by Wendy Weatherby and performed by Wendy Weatherby on cello, Pete Clark on fiddle, and Marzetti on harp. Now the reading will take a little over 15 minutes. Chapter 20, The Flight in the Heather. The Rocks. Sometimes we walked, sometimes ran, and as it drew on to morning, walked ever the less and ran the more. Though upon its face that country appeared to be a desert, yet there were huts and houses of the people, of which we must have passed more than 20, hidden in quiet places of the hills. When we came to one of these, Alan would leave me in the way and go himself and rap upon the side of the house and speak a while at the window with some sleeper awakened. This was to pass the news, which in that country was as much of a duty that Alan must pause to attend to it, even while fleeing for his life, and so well attended to by others that in more than half the houses where we called they had heard already of the murder. In the others, as well as I could make out, standing back at a distance and hearing a strange tongue, the news was received with more of consternation than surprise. For all our hurry, the day began to come in while we were still far from any shelter. It found us in a prodigious valley, strewn with rocks, and where ran a foaming river. Wild mountains stood around it, and there grew neither grass nor trees. And I have sometimes thought since that it may have been the valley called Glencoe, where the massacre was in the time of King William. But for the details of our itinerary, I'm all to seek. Our way lying now by short cuts, now by great detours, our pace being so hurried, our time of journeying usually by night, and the names of such places as I asked and heard being in the Gaelic tongue, and the more easily forgotten. The first peep of morning then showed us this horrible place, and I could see Alan knit his brow. "This is no fit place for you and me," he said. "This is a place they're bound to watch." And with that, he ran harder than ever down to the waterside, in a part where the river was split in two among three rocks. It went through with a horrid thundering that made my belly quake, and there hung over the linn a little mist of spray. Alan looked neither to the right nor to the left, but jumped clean upon the middle rock and fell there on his hands and knees to check himself, for that rock was small, and he might have pitched over on the far side. I had scarce time to measure the distance or to understand the peril before I had followed him, and he had caught and stopped me. So there we stood, side by side upon a small rock, slippery with spray, a far broader leap in front of us, and the river dinning upon all sides. When I saw where I was, there came upon me a deadly sickness of fear, and I put my hands over my eyes. Alan shook me and shook me again. I saw he was speaking, but the roaring of the falls and the trouble of my mind prevented me from hearing. Only I saw his face was red with anger and that he stamped upon the rock. The same look showed me the water raging by and in the mist hanging in the air, and with that I covered my eyes again and shuddered. The next minute, Alan had set the brandy bottle to my lips and forced me to drink about a gill, which sent the blood into my head again. Then, putting his hands to his mouth and his mouth to my ear, he shouted, "Hang or drown!" and, turning his back upon me, leaped over the farther branch of the stream and landed safe. I was now alone upon the rock, which gave me the more room. The brandy was singing in my ears. I had this good example fresh before me, and just wit enough to see that if I did not leap at once, I should never leap at all. I bent low on my knees and flung myself forth with that kind of anger of despair that has sometimes stood me instead of courage. And sure enough, it was but my hands that reached the full length. These slipped, caught again, slipped again, and I was slithering back to the linn when Alan seized me, first by the hair, then by the collar, and with a great strain dragged me into safety. Never a word he said, but set off running again for his life, and I must stagger to my feet and run after him. I had been weary before, but now I was sick and bruised and partly drunken with the brandy. I kept stumbling as I ran. I had a stitch that came near to overmaster me, and when at last Alan paused under a great rock that stood there among a number of others, it was none too soon for David Balfour. A great rock, I have said, but by rights it was two rocks leaning together at the top, both some 20 feet high, and at the first sight inaccessible. Even Alan, though you may say he had as good as four hands, failed twice in an attempt to climb them, and it was only at the third trial, and then by standing on my shoulders and leaping up with such force as I thought must have broken my collarbone, that he secured a lodgment. Once there, he let down his leathern girdle, and with the aid of that and a pair of shallow footholds in the rock, I scrambled up beside him. Then I saw why we had come there, for the two rocks, being both somewhat hollow at the top and sloping one to the other, made a kind of dish or saucer where as many as 3 or 4 men might have lain hidden. All this while Alan had not said a word, but had run and climbed with such a savage, silent frenzy of hurry that I knew that he was in mortal fear of some miscarriage. Even now we were on the rock, he said nothing, nor so much as relaxed the frowning look upon his face, but clapped flat down, and keeping only one eye above the edge of our place of shelter, scouted all around the compass. The dawn had come, quite clear. We could see the stony sides of the valley, and at his bottom, which was bestrewed with rocks, and the river, which went from one side to another, and made white falls. But nowhere the smoke of a house, nor any living creature but some eagles screaming round the cliff. And then at last Alan smiled. "Aye," said he, "now we have a chance." And then looking at me with some amusement, "You're no very gleg at the jumping," said he. At this I suppose I coloured with mortification, for he added at once, "Hoot, small blame to ye. To be feared of a thing and yet to do it is what makes the prettiest kind of a man. And then there was the water there, and water's a thing that dauntons even me." "No, no," said Alan, "it's no you that's to blame, it's me." I asked him why. "Why," said he, "I have proved myself a gomeral this night. For first of all, I take a wrong road, and that in my own country of Appin, so that the day has caught us where we should never have been. And thanks to that, we lie here in some danger and mere discomfort. And next, which is the worst of the two for a man that has been so long, so much among the heather as myself, I have come wanting a water bottle, and here we lie for a long summer's day with nothing but neat spirit. You may think that a small matter, but before it comes night, David, you'll give me news of it." I was anxious to redeem my character, and offered if he would pour out the brandy to run down and fill the bottle at the river. "I wouldn't waste the good spirit either," says he. "It's been a good friend to you this night, or in my poor opinion you would still be cocking on yon stone. And what's more," says he, "you may have observed, you that's a man of so much penetration, that Alan Breck Stewart was perhaps walking quicker than his ordinaire." "You," I cried, "you were running fit to burst." "Was I so?" said he. "Well, then, you may depend upon it there was nae time to be lost. And now, here's enough said. Gang ye to your sleep, lad, and I'll watch." Accordingly, I lay down to sleep. A little peaty earth had drifted in between the top of the two rocks, and some bracken grew there to be a bed to me. The last thing I heard was still the crying of the eagles. I dare say it would be 9 in the morning when I was roughly awakened and found Alan's hand pressed upon my mouth. "Wheesht," he whispered, "ye were snoring." "Well," I said, surprised at his anxious and dark face, "and why not?" He peered over the edge of the rock and signed to me to do the like. It was now high day, cloudless and very hot. The valley was as clear as in a picture. About 1/2 mile up the water was a camp of redcoats. A big fire blazed in their midst, at which some were cooking, and nearby, on the top of a rock, about as high as ours, there stood a sentry, with the sun sparkling on his arms. All the way down along the riverside were posted other sentries, here near together, there widely or scattered, some planted like the first on places of command, some on the ground level, and marching and countermarching so as to meet halfway. Higher up the glen, where the ground was more open, the chain of posts was continued by horse soldiers, whom we could see in the distance riding to and fro. Lower down the infantry continued, but as the stream was suddenly swelled by the confluence of a considerable burn, they were more widely set and only watched the fords and stepping stones. I took but one look at them and ducked again to my place. It was strange indeed to see this valley, which had lain so solitary in the hour of dawn, bristling with arms and dotted with the red coats and breeches. "You see," said Alan, "this is what I was afraid of, Davy, that they would watch the burnside. They began to come in about 2 hours ago, and man, but you're a grand hand that's sleeping. We're in a narrow place. If they get up the sides of the hill, they could easily spy us with a glass. But if they'll only keep on the foot of the valley, we'll do yet. The posts are thinner down the water, and come night, we'll try our hand at getting by them. And what are we to do till night? I asked. Lie here, he said, and bursle. That one good Scotch word, bustle, bursle, was indeed the most of the story of the day that we had now to pass. You are to remember that we lay on the bare top of a rock, like scones upon a girdle. The sun beat upon us cruelly. The rock grew so heated a man could scarce endure the touch of it, and the little patch of earth and fern which kept cooler was only large enough for one at a time. We took turn to lie about on the naked rock, which was indeed like the position of that saint that was martyred on a gridiron. And it ran in my mind how strange it was that in the same climate and at only a few days' distance I should have suffered so cruelly, first from cold upon my island, and now from heat upon this rock. All the while we had no water, only raw brandy for a drink, which was worse than nothing. But we kept the bottle as cool as we could, burying it in the earth, and got some relief by bathing our breasts and temples. The soldiers kept stirring all day in the bottom of the valley, now changing guard, now in patrolling parties hunting among the rocks. These lay round in so great a number that to look for men among them was like looking for a needle in a bottle of hay, and being so hopeless a task, it was gone about with less care. Yet we could see the soldiers pike their bayonets among the heather, which sent a cold thrill into my vitals, and they would sometimes hang about our rock so that we scarce dared to breathe. The tediousness and pain of these hours upon the rock grew only the greater as the day went on, the rock getting still the hotter and the sun fiercer. There were giddiness and sickness and sharp pangs like rheumatism to be supported. I minded then, and have often minded since, on the lines of our Scotch psalm, "The moon by night thee shall not smite, nor yet the sun by day." And indeed it was only by God's blessing that we were neither of us sun-smitten. At last, about 2, it was beyond men's bearing, and there was now temptation to resist, as well as pain to thole. The sun being now got a little to the west, there came a patch of shade on the east side of our rock, which was the side sheltered from the soldiers. "As well one death as another," said Alan, and slipped over the edge and dropped on the ground on the shadowy side. I followed him at once, and instantly fell all my length, so weak was I and so giddy with that long exposure. Here then we lay for an hour or two, aching from head to foot, as weak as water, and lying quite naked to the eye of any soldier who should have strolled that way. None came, however, all passing by on the other side, so that our rock continued to be our shield even in this new position. Presently we began to get a little strength, and as the soldiers were now lying closer along the riverside, Alan proposed that we should try a start. I was by this time afraid of but one thing in the world, and that was to be back upon the rock. Anything else was welcome to me, so we got ourselves at once in marching order and began to slip from rock to rock, one after the other, now crawling flat on our bellies in the shade, now making a run for it, heart in mouth. The soldiers, having searched this side of the valley after a fashion, and being perhaps somewhat sleepy with the sultriness of the afternoon, had now laid by much of their vigilance, and stood dozing at their posts, or only kept a lookout along the banks of the river, so that in this way, keeping down the valley and at the same time towards the mountains, we drew steadily away from their neighbourhood. But the business was the most wearing I had ever taken part in. A man had need of 100 eyes in every part of him to keep concealed in that uneven country and within cry of so many and scattered sentries. When we must pass an open place, quickness was not all, but a swift judgment not only of the lie of the whole country, but of the solidity of every stone on which we must set foot, for the afternoon was now fallen so breathless that the rolling of a pebble sounded abroad like a pistol shot, and would start the echo calling among the hills and cliffs. By sundown we had made some distance, even by our own slow rate of progress, though to be sure the sentry on the rock was still plainly in our view. But now we came on something that put all fears out of season, and that was a deep, rushing burn that tore down in that part to join the Glen River. At the sight of this, we cast ourselves on the ground and plunged head and shoulders into the water. And I cannot tell which was the more pleasant, the great shock as the cool stream went over us, or the greed with which we drank of it. We lay there, for the banks hid us, and drank again and again, bathed our chests, let our wrists trail in the running water till they ached with the chill, and at last, being wonderfully renewed, we got out the meal bag and made dramak in the iron pan. This, though it is but cold water mingled with oatmeal, yet makes a good enough dish for a hungry man, and where there are no means of making fire, or, as in our case, good reason for not making one, it is the chief standby of those who have taken to the heather. As soon as the shadow of the night had fallen, we set forth again, at first with the same caution, but presently with more boldness, standing our full height and stepping out at a good pace of walking. The way was very intricate, lying up the steep sides of mountains and along the brows of cliffs. Clouds had come in with the sunset, and the night was dark and cool, so that I walked without much fatigue, but in continual fear of falling and rolling down the mountains, and with no guess at our direction. The moon rose at last and found us still on the road. It was in its last quarter, and was long beset with clouds, but after a while shone out and showed me many dark heads of mountains, and was reflected far underneath us on the narrow arm of a sea loch. At this sight we both paused. I, struck with wonder to find myself so high, and walking, as it seemed to me, upon clouds. Alan, to make sure of his direction. Seemingly he was well pleased, and he must certainly have judged us out of earshot of all our enemies, for throughout the rest of our night march he beguiled the way with whistling of many tunes, warlike, merry, plaintive, real tunes that made the foot go faster, tunes of my own south country that made me fain to be home from my adventures, and all these on the great, dark, desert mountains, making company upon the way.
Let us leave the city where the black smoke blows. When the wind comes calling, let us go, go, go. It's the west wind calling, it's the wind that's free. Come away and wander on the road with me. Then give us a road that stretches far, by the moor of Rannoch or by dark Lochnagar, by the glens of Angus or by Deeside Fair. On the road of summer you will find us there. Shoulder up your bundles, throw away your cares. There's no place for worries on the highway there. When the sun is dawning with the promise gay, and the hills are calling, come away, come away. Then give us a road that stretches far, by the moor of Rannoch or by dark Lochnagar, by the glens of Angus or by Deeside Fair. On the road of summer you will find us there. There's a thousand roads and we shall walk them all, till the songbirds leave us and the white snows fall. Then we'll dream all winter of the great spring day, when the wind shall call us, come away, come away. Then give us a road that stretches far, by the moor of Rannoch or by dark Lochnagar, by the glens of Angus or by Deeside Fair. On the road of summer you will find us there. On the road of summer you will find us there.
And so, as David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart continued their flight across the Highlands, Alan beguiling the way with whistling of many tunes, we moved on to Andy Stewart singing The Summer Road, a song of the call of the road, not quite the same as a flight through the heather, though with rather too much vinyl crackle, I notice. Obviously, the red coats connected to the summer energy. Here, not as compassion, but as a threat, hostility, aggression, taking over other people's land. But Alan and David? Yes, there's the summer energy of love growing between them as we see them help each other and cooperate for the common good. Later we will see them quarrel, but that's not at this moment. I would like to move us now to another flight in the blistering sun, this time set in the Mexican state of Durango. As part of his long-standing love of the myths of the West, Bob Dylan wrote the ballad Romance in Durango, which appeared on his album Desire. There's a good summer heat word. Like all ballads, it gives us only disconnected glimpses of a story, which we then have to piece together. In this case, all we have are the words of a fugitive, partly to us, whoever we are, and partly to his querida Magdalena, as they make their way across the desert, or perhaps stop for rest. We pick up the story bit by bit. Life was easy for this man, as easy as he could expect, back in his hometown, until in some passionate rage or other he shot Ramon, perhaps a friend of his, but certainly someone who has brothers and cousins out to seek revenge, and now hot on the trail of this couple. All this passion stirred up by the summer heat. Not to mention the passion of the speaker towards Magdalena, whom he consoles with the picture of her wearing diamonds on her wedding dress. No llores, mi querida, he says to her. Don't cry, my dear. God watches over us. Dios nos vigila. Soon the horse will take us to Durango. Agarrame, mi vida. Grab me, my life, presumably as she sits behind him on the horse. Soon the desert will be gone. Soon you will be dancing the fandango. How is she going to rhyme with Durango, but fandango, right? How long have they been out on the trail? One day? A week? We don't know. But that's irrelevant. The journey will soon be over. Either they will make it to Durango, or that sound of thunder, that flash of light up in the hills, well, what is it? Did he ever think they would make it safely? Or has he been singing just to reassure Magdalena? The power of the song comes from all the uncertainties. We just have to hold on to the few details we're given. The song was written by Bob Dylan and Jacques Levy during a very creative period of collaboration in the mid-70s. I've been talking about the lyrics, but the song's energy seems to come even more from the attempt to capture many different touches of Mexican music in the performance, and the yearning mandolin and violin playing off each other, and the restless accordion. Watch how it creeps up on us with the unobtrusive opening until it hits us with the line, hot chili peppers in the blistering sun.
Hot chili peppers in the blistering sun.
Bob Dylan's Romance in Durango, finishing up our show this week, looking at summer heat. Hey, before we go, let me wish you all the right sort of summer heat over the next several weeks, both inner heat and outer heat. And as we began with Vivaldi, let's end with him too, the passionate presto movement from summer, as we say goodnight from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for attending Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 and looking forward to seeing you next time. Bye now. Thank you.
Thank you.